Hi, Keegan. Welcome to Think Visual with Shapeshifters.
Thanks, Alan.
Super glad and excited that you've come back here. Keegan was our second ever speaker for Think Visual, so it's an honor to bring you back. We loved your talk back when we were chatting. And yeah, I think we'd love to hear more about your story. So yeah, tell us a little bit about yourself, Keegan.
Well, thanks for having me. It's always great to speak to you guys. And my story is that currently what I do is I run my own business that is all about supporting team performance. So I help leaders, teams, organizations have high performance so they can get the outcomes that they want. And so often people are struggling to get the results that they want, and they don't realize it's often because their teams aren't functioning in the way they'd like to. And I help them to get the teams functioning together. So that means I work with leaders about one-on-one to help, you know, how can they work with their teams. I work with intact leadership and executive teams, and I work with leaders across organizations to help a lot of teams across the organization through the leaders. That's what I do, and I've kind of got a very windy road that has led me here, and in many ways it feels like a game of career guess who. It's like stuff that I didn't like, I realized, oh, I don't like that, I don't like that, and I don't like that, and the work that I do now emerged as the stuff that I love, that I'm good at, that adds value. And so that's sort of where I'm at. And maybe we could sort of give a bit of context around some of those things that have led there. Back as a kid, you know, and ever since I was a kid, I played cricket, which is a team sport. And I realized ever since I've been the age of 8, I have been looking at team performance, and cricket being this unique sort of thing where there's actually a team game, but like a series of individual like matchups in as you go. Like it's at any given time it's batter versus bowler, but in the context of what's happening for the team and around there. And so from a very young age, more than my daughter now plays netball, and even when she's shooting, we don't really count how many goals she scored. Like, how did your team go? How did you go? And soccer and a lot of the other sports are like that. So from that age, you're not really, your individual stats aren't kept quite so tightly. But, you know, ever since I was, you know, how many runs did you score? How many wickets did you take? How many catches did you take? Were always the things that were tracked. And they were kind of measures around how did I do? But I was always, you know, interested in how did I help us win? And the more I played, the more I realized that there were some people that were really good to be on their team because they were just really good cricketers. You know, like, especially when you're little, like if the guy's bigger and stronger, he's really good to have on your team. And as people, you know, that kind of evens itself out, like the more skilled players on your team are really good to have. But there's also other people who are really good to have on your team that aren't necessarily the best skillfully, but they make the rest of the team better. And I think that ever since I've been young, I've been exposed to that, and I've got really curious about what is that? What are the things that people do to make teams better that aren't necessarily just the skills? And the other thing, being around like a whole bunch of teams where people are really good at their thing and still terrible teammates. Yeah. Actually make it harder for others to do their job well. Like, it's all about them, and it's not about the team. And I think only in the last few years I've realized that those experiences keep on shaping the way that I see much of the world, and definitely the way that I see teams in organizations. See this sense that teams have this opportunity to A, be a great experience to be a part of, to achieve things that you can't achieve by yourself, and to make sort of a more resilient and longer lasting impact. Teams have that opportunity to do that. And also that there are things that we can do, we can help people do, and we can take a more deliberate approach, and it doesn't just happen by accident. And I think that that's kind of one of the key things that has led me to that. And along the way, I've been in, you know, I've got a grad dip ed, and I've run my own little business doing primary school PE teaching, which was super cool. Been a PE teacher at various little times. Always been around sort of, my undergrad degree was in exercise and sports science. So it's always been about how do you help people get better at doing stuff. Had some corporate roles, and then coming up to 10 years ago now, started my master's of business coaching. And that kind of, you know, when I talk about that guess who game, like, it's like, ah, oh, right, it's got to be this. You know, the principles of coaching applied into the context of an organization and helping teams perform well is like, this is the thing. So that's how I landed here.
Yeah, wow. What a cool story. It makes me, I was just going to reflect that what you said about teams and having kind of people who are better teammates and not necessarily the best individual sportsmen. It makes me think of that thing that Simon Sinek was talking about with, you know, with the Marines, and how he says that the Marines are arguably one of the most high-functioning, best-performing teams in the world. And part of their selection process is that they would, you know, place greater emphasis on somebody who is a great team member than somebody who is just individually the best and ultimate soldier. Why do you think that is?
I think, you know, with the example of Marines, right? Like, there's a cost of entry, right? Like, they're not just picking just someone who is a good team member. They've also got to have a very, very high level of skills to be in there, like whatever the Marine skills are. And then the differences aren't as significant there for the collective performance as some of those other things you've spoken about. So do we trust each other? Will this person back us up? Will this person make good decisions under pressure? Will this person consider us or just them? Those are things that are like mission critical and life critical in that situation. And so they invest a lot more in thinking about how is this team going to function, because the team is like, has like, those are life and death consequences that they have there. And so they really do need to think about the dynamics in that team will make an impact on the decisions that get made and the actions that we take. And therefore they're thinking about that. And I think what I see in organizations is that we don't really think that that's going to happen. We don't really think that the dynamics in the team are going to impact the decisions that we make and the actions that we take, but they do. But I think the stakes are so high for the Marines that it sort of becomes this really clear example of like, that's, they're imagining, who do I want next to me when this goes down? And that's a very different way that we often think about that. When we recruit in organizations, it's like, well, who's got the best skills to add in, and the rest will figure itself out. And there's a whole bunch of evidence that that's not what actually happens, right? Like, you can put, you know, Adam Grant talks about this idea of like the problem with all-stars, having too many all-stars in your team can be a problem. And it's like, you see it in sport, in research, in academia, all these sorts of situations where the individual talent isn't actually the determining factor when it comes to the collective performance. And the Marines, where I think you look anywhere where results really, really matter, like where there's life and death and stuff, or there's like big, big consequences of the results that you get, like you talk about elite sport, military, space travel, you know, operating theaters and all this sort of thing, they really, really value how well is this team going to work. They really acknowledge it and they really think about it. So when everywhere you look, when like, okay, we really need to have the results, they think about what's going on in the team and how do we get the right team and not just the best individuals.
Wow. I wonder how much we're actually missing out by, you know, not thinking about it in that way. I mean, and by we as in businesses, you know, how much are they missing out? I have a question about high performing teams.
Yeah.
I've heard this stat that 20% of teams are high performing teams. What exactly does it mean to be a high performing team? And is it true that it's 20%?
It seems to be somewhere around there. So the research I've looked at typically bounces around between sort of 17 and 25% mm-hmm. over the last sort of couple of decades, really, and different people have measured it in different ways, and it tends to seem to be, it's somewhere in that range. So 20% is a pretty good estimate. And it really depends on what people, how people define high performing. And one of the things I like to do when I'm talking to people is separate this idea of how effective is our team. So the results is our effectiveness, and our behaviors are our performance. And so a high performing team is a team that does the behaviors that they think are going to get them results, and are behaving in the way that they want to, that they think are likely to get the results. Because I think we can get sort of blurred between thinking, well, we're getting results, therefore we're a high performing team. And that's, I think we can all think of examples of where teams have got results in spite of how they behave, not because of how they behave. And the inverse can happen. It's like, you're doing all the right things, but you're not getting the results that you want. So I'd say a high performing team is a team that has those behavioral patterns that they have decided will, that they want to commit, that are likely to get them their results. They might be wrong about getting the results, but they're doing the things they said they wanted to do. And so, like, to just flesh that out a little bit more, if you're a sales team and you've got a product, like, if you're a terrible sales team, but as of February, March 2020, you were selling Zoom, like, you're going to, like, it doesn't matter. Like, the situation around, like, you couldn't not sell Zoom subscriptions. Like, if, like, how could you not? Just because the situation around that just meant, like, you could be a really terrible team, but it's almost impossible not to do well because of the situation. That same team could, you know, use those same behaviors in a different market and do really, like, get, not get the results, or vice versa, where if you're just selling a product where, you know, again, we use that kind of COVID sort of situation, where if you were selling face-to-face conferences like a whole bunch of people were, it doesn't matter how well you're doing that, like, you're doing all the right things, that thing, all the circumstances around you just meant that doesn't matter, your behaviors might be right, you're performing well, but you're not getting the results. So to answer your question, the teams that I think are high performing are the ones that are behaving in the way that they have decided that they want to. There's a whole bunch of teams that don't even know how they want to behave, but they've decided that they want to get the results that they are seeking, not necessarily that they're getting the results.
Speaking of results, I've seen you get results through a number of different ways. And I think one of the ways that I notice that you work in is using visuals, and, you know, how you kind of articulate your ideas with visuals, but also, you know, how you facilitate people and, you know, facilitate teams and discussions using visuals. Can you tell us a little bit about the role that visuals play in getting a team to align, or getting a team to understand what it is that you're talking about? Can we do a little bit of exploration around that?
Yeah, sure. So I think that one of the things that often holds teams back from performing in the way that they want to are some of the assumptions they have about what teams are and how they work. And so that's where I find quite often visuals can facilitate conversations and to help people to express or explore some ideas around what are some of the assumptions around how we think the teams work. And once we get that done, then you can start making some decisions. Okay, so do we want to operate in this way, and how do we get there, and all that sort of thing. And so visuals, I think, are just so helpful for guiding and capturing the narrative of a team. So one exercise that I'll do with a team is like, all right, tell me what was, what is, and what will be. Like, where has your team been? Where are you now? And where are you going? And sort of asking them to very deliberately talk about where you're going. And they can use, they'll use different images, they'll use different colors, there'll be different sizes involved, there'll be different locations, and sort of, like, you know, quite often where they're going will be sort of higher and to the right on a wall. We're doing this on a wall. It's like, okay, interesting, you know, and sort of helping them talk through that, and it feels more tangible, feels like they've got more agency in the whole process. And I think that's one of the things that I'm trying to do when I'm working with teams, is saying, like, you are authoring this, you are a part of this system that is going to function in a certain way, and you can make some choices about this. Like, you can't change necessarily what was and what is, but you can from here choose what will be. And so having them interacting with that, having them creating it themselves is really important, and that the visuals help it become less of an intellectual exercise and a bit more of a kind of interpersonal and sort of engaging exercise that really becomes like, there's a whole bunch of good things that come out of using visuals. So it becomes an artifact, so they can refer back to it. It lives on the walls while we're doing the work, and then I'll send them photos of that afterwards. And if I'm working with, if we've partnered, then they get a very refined and very sort of distilled version of that. But even if it's just me and them and their images, there is something they can come back to that is theirs, and it's not something that has been imposed on by me or someone else. It is, there's some decisions that they've made, and they can keep referring back to that. And that's, again, if we come back to high performing, it's like deciding how we want to perform or how we want to behave, and are we doing that? And so this is, you know, all the visuals quite often help that. And there's some sometimes complex and sometimes not very complex concepts that come up in conversation, and being able to graphically do that. Sometimes I think what my job is to give different doors to the same house. And so I will say something using research, I will say something using a metaphor like I just did, I'll use something, you know, then graphics is another example. And, you know, like I'm trying to use different ways to enable people to explore the same idea. And it doesn't matter to me whether the metaphor is what landed for them or it's the story, whatever, like, cool. It's like, we're trying to look at this same thing from different angles and then helping people to, like, oh, that one, that was, because especially if it's a new team that I'm just working with, I don't know. If I'm working with a team for a longer period of time, I can say like, oh, okay, this is going to work for you, Deanna, this is going to work for you, Alan, or whatever. But if I don't know, then I'm throwing out a whole bunch of different ways for people to engage with, and then we'll often create our own language, both visual and verbal. And that's one of the things that high-performing teams, Daniel Coyle has a book called Culture Code. And in that book, he talks about how high-performing groups have these shortcut languages. And quite often, imagery can be part of that shortcut.
Yeah, wow. I really love that metaphor you said with different doors to the same house, using visuals to provide multiple pathways. There was a great example that you mentioned last time, something around the London Underground, and the difference between a diagram and a map.
Yeah.
Can you kind of unbox that a little bit?
Yeah, I love that example. I can't remember exactly where I first heard of it, but the sense that, you know, the London Underground, when it was first released, the authorities there produced a really accurate map of the network. And so it had all the topographical features. It had the parks and the rivers and the streets and the roads, and it was correct. So the way that the track went was sort of, it showed the route that the track went. It showed exactly how far apart all of the stations were, and people were overwhelmed by it and didn't use it very much. And an electrical engineer, I think he was an electrical network engineer, came in and said, you don't need a map. What you need is a network diagram. And he created what the thing that we are very familiar with now, which is actually quite inaccurate in many senses. So the stations are exactly the same distance apart. The tracks, according to the diagram, only run, you know, horizontally, vertically at 45 degrees. They're color-coded, sort of thing. But he produced this, and then they couldn't keep up with printing them enough. People found them so useful, they wanted a copy, and they put it into practice straight away. And I think a lot of us are guilty of that quite often. Sort of, we want to create the map, we know the subject matter so intimately, we are so caught in the detail. And actually what we need to create for ourselves and others are diagrams that have enough accuracy, so like, it doesn't work if the two stations that are next to each other on the map are actually on opposite sides of the city. So there needs to have enough integrity in the map, but they're useful enough and have the principles enough that are able to be put to use. And that approach is now basically the gold standard for how you, like, I don't know if there's a city in the world that has a train network that doesn't use a network diagram as opposed to a map. It's so useful. And I think about, you know, it's a long time ago now, but I was in Tokyo, don't speak Japanese, don't read Japanese, but was able to get myself around because the diagram was something I was familiar with. It was a way of communicating where things were relative to each other and how I would navigate myself from one point to the other. It's just, I love that as a metaphor in my head around this idea of what's the diagram here that we can actually put to use, as opposed to the map that has all of the intricate detail that can become overwhelming, even if it's accurate.
Yeah, wow. Do you yourself use diagrams to communicate with teams?
Yeah, I think it's one of the things I try and do a lot. You know, one of the things I make a sort of overly simplistic distinction between working as an individual, working as a group, and working as a team. In reality, the lines are a lot more blurred than that, but we sort of make the distinctions between them. And I sort of have diagrams for each of those levels, and we talk about what does it look like working as an individual, as a group, as a team, what's the role of the leader in each of these situations. And those diagrams facilitate really useful conversations. Even though they're more simplistic than the reality, they actually really help people to go and explore, okay, so when do we need to work as individuals, and when does it serve us to be sort of hierarchically structured, and when does it serve us to be more interdependent as teams? And those diagrams that are a simplification of reality actually really help that conversation that ultimately helps the teams make some decisions and then take actions. And that's kind of the flow, I think, that the kind of the diagram that gives the helps make decisions and take actions.
Yeah, wow. I was going to say, in our kind of past interactions, I've seen that you're very good at articulating your ideas. Like you speak in a way that's extremely visual, but you're also very skilled at working and knowing where to use visuals. Can you tell us a little bit about you know, how you might do that and how other people might leverage that same kind of skill?
I think, thank you for that. I don't really think of myself as a visual thinker, and I think it is in working with you that you've kind of pointed out, and I've honed and built that skill a little bit, but also you've just pointed out that, oh, that's actually something you do possess. And I think that visual thinking is really helpful for, like what we were just talking about, just abstracting something from really complex just a little bit so we can actually engage with it and we can talk about it. So sort of I like to think about it as distilling an idea rather than simplifying an idea. So like I think simplifying sometimes we can oversimplify, but if we distill it down to the key components, then it really helps some conversations. So I think that when there's a lot of complexity involved, that doing the thinking to capture that visually can be a real service to the people that I'm working with and for me. So I think that's one of the things. When you get onto something that you want people to be able to reconnect with readily, I think that diagrams are really helpful. Whether it's like, so often it's like a 2x2, right? Like, or a Venn diagram or something like that. So something like that that helps people reconnect back to a concept. It's, again, it's got to be, it can have a lot sitting underneath it, but it's something that's a time when I think I want to be using visuals. And also when it is a little bit more conceptual. And so when I'm talking about, you know, one of the things I'll talk about is that your org chart is lying to you. And so this idea that like you can, even in saying that, you'll almost definitely people have a pyramid in their mind, like a version of a pyramid in their mind. It's like, that's not how work gets done. It gets done as a network. And it kind of, that network is harder to describe, and it's much easier to draw. When you draw that, people get it a lot more simply, or I show a version of what they call organizational network analysis, how organizations actually work with each other. And you contrast that with the org chart that we all still use, you can see that difference. And so there's times when my language is insufficient to explain the message, and that's where I lean on visuals a lot.
Yeah, wow. Well, Kicken, if people want to connect with you outside of this little conversation, what's the best place to find you?
The best place is on LinkedIn.
Yep.
And so that's a great spot to find me. I'm relatively active on there. I try and share a few thoughts on there pretty regularly. And if people want any of the stuff that I do with teams, well, some of the stuff that I do with teams, they can go to teamership.com.au/resources. There's a bunch of the reflection guides, so some questions people can ask themselves, and a discussion guide, so questions that people can ask others that can help to have some of the conversations that tend to work and help team performance.
Yeah, wow. We'll make sure that we put in all of those details into the show notes, as well as some of the books and stuff that you've written, which we know you've done several now, right?
Two.
Yeah.
Awesome. More than one.
Fantastic. Well, Kicken, thank you so much for coming along today, and hope to see you again soon. And we hope to share this episode very shortly.
Thanks for having me, mate.
Awesome.